tracks around Australia. Here's Inside Motorsport.
And yes, we're back again for another week of all the latest news of motorsport around Australia and around the world, with lots of things happening both here in Australia and overseas. Of course, this weekend, the Safari Rally running over in Kenya, and as always, it's producing some good fun and games. In Jerez over in Spain, they've just tidied up the final testing over there, and a few interesting things happening in Spain with the Formula One testing. Of course, we're in the countdown to the Australian Grand Prix in Melbourne in a fortnight's time. And of course, all sorts of news and information we're going to be bringing to you today.
Drag racing action,
yeah, you know it. And of course, I'm panelling tonight, Colin Ford, and on the other side of the panel for a change, Craig Ravelli, sort of going to sit here and, you know, watch me eagle-eyed and cringe as I go and hit the wrong button. But first up, the good news this week about a man who's got it, the drive he's been looking for. Jason Bright signs for Doricot Racing. Jason, welcome to the show.
How you going, guys? Thanks very much.
Well, good to have you back with us again. Now, you're signing with Doricot Racing, the top guys in the 2000 Dayton Indy Lights Championship. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that deal you've done?
Yeah, it's very, very pleasing to finally get a deal put to bed, and to be with the championship-winning team from 1999 is more than a dream come true, I must say.
With the deal, you got the full season there with them. You know that you're going to have to head off soon and start testing, pre-season testing with them.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a rush. The deal came together a little later than what we would have hoped, but you know, we haven't missed out on any testing. The season doesn't start till the 10th of April, and you know, I'm heading over basically straight away to start testing in preparation for that first round.
Now, the race series is the undercard to the CARP PPG, FedEx Championship Series, as it's called now. So one of the parts of the deal that you were looking to do was to guarantee yourself a run at the Surfers Paradise event. Has that also come through?
Yeah, we're still working on that at the moment. It's all looking reasonable. There's a number of different options there. And you know, we'll just keep on working that. The priority at the moment is to get over there and do well in Indy Lights. And you know, maybe that'll open up a few other doors for us.
Now, whereabouts in the states are you going to be based over there, Jason?
The team itself is based in Bakersfield, California, but the majority of the races are in the Midwest, and you know, we're sort of looking at the moment at getting a motorhome. Actually, it just sort of serves a couple of purposes at once, and you know, isn't a bad way of sort of seeing a bit of the country at the same time.
Get that man a Winnebago. Now, of course, for you, it's probably going to be something different, you know, in terms of the United States, just discovering how big that place is, but also getting around and being one of the new boys on the block in the championship.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's going to be a very big year for me. We're racing a lot of tracks that I haven't raced at before. Obviously, I have to learn those tracks. There are a number of tracks that we do get to test on beforehand, but the majority of the tracks are street tracks and tracks that we aren't able to test at. And yeah, it is a bit of a challenge to go to those tracks and expect to do well with you know, a lot of the drivers having raced there before. So you know, I'm not underestimating at all how big a challenge this year is going to be, but at the same time, I think you know that the Doricot team, with their experience and the quality of the engineers and that involved with the team, I've certainly got a pretty good leg up to be able to make a few shortcuts at those meetings.
The sponsorship wise,
I'm having trouble hearing you there, mate. Sorry.
Sponsorship wise, of course, Gillette and KPMG have been helping you out quite a bit. But what was the eventual thing that got you over the line?
It really, you know, it has been very hard to raise the money required to do an Indy Lights season over there. I guess the key factor is, through the whole deal, has been Bob Doricot for being so understanding and you know, being so patient in order for us to be able to put a deal together. And you know, even though we don't have any dollars secured yet, he's taken quite a big risk and is underwriting the whole drive himself. But you know, at the same time, there's a bit of risk on his behalf and a bit of risk on my behalf. And you know, we're both having a pretty big go at this. And you know, I think it's really all come down to Bob Doricot's you know, determination to sign somebody that, you know, he wanted to sign.
does it amaze you just how hard it has been to get a sponsor, considering you've got plenty of form on the board, you've got plenty of form in America on the board as well?
Yeah, it's been a bit harder than what I expected, and it has been, you know, frustrating at times that, you know, we haven't been able to raise the money, but I guess now, you know, it's great that the deal has come off. Now we can get out there and you know, we can work on getting all the exposure that is available, and I'm sure we can get some companies involved through, you know, the interest that we're going to be able to stir up during this year.
Yeah, maybe you should go and talk to the Queensland Tourist Commission, because with the IndyCar race being up there on the Gold Coast, they might be able to put something back into it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the having an Australian in the event on the Gold Coast is going to be huge, and you know, until an Australian driver is able to crack an entry into that race or into the Formula One race at Albert Park, it's really hard to prove the exposure that's available. And you know, it's been a long time since we've had a competitive Australian driver competing in Formula One in or Champ Cars, and so a lot of companies out there don't realise the exposure that's available. But you know, I think between Mark Webber and myself, we're both out there to prove that the exposure is there, and you know, over the next 12 months, hopefully we'll see a lot more support happening for Australian drivers wanting to compete overseas.
And one thing a lot of Australians don't realise is that Jeff Brabham has got a Champ Car victory at least under his belt when he and Teo Favi were developing the Porsches back in the early 80s. So it's not as if Australians haven't been part of this series before. It's just that Australians and sponsors have been quite willing to neglect them.
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem, you know, both Mark and myself have had is it's been so long. You know, there's no doubting that Australian drivers over the years have certainly had the form to compete in Champ Cars or Formula One. It's just been very hard to get to the categories that really matter, like your Indy Lights or your Formula 3000, to prove to the Champ Car and Formula One teams that you know, Australia can produce some very good talent.
Well, Jason, looks like you've got yourself a very interesting year ahead of you. Hopefully we'll try and keep track of you during the year. We'll stay in contact to follow you with the Zorikot team in the Dayton Indy Lights Championship. From us here, we know that we offer you the best of luck for the year, and hopefully you can show those Americans what some of the races are like from down under.
Yeah, I'll certainly be giving a good shake, don't you worry.
Jason Bright, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And we had Jason Bright joining us on the line from up in his home. Of course, this week, as we mentioned, lots of things happening around the world, and of course, one of the announcements coming from the UK this week was about some changes being made to the Independence Cup in the British Touring Car Championship, where there is a jackpot of £10,000 waiting the overall winner of the British Touring Car Championship's Michelin Cup for Independence. But the interesting part is that the package that they have for privateers in the British Touring Car Championship this year includes guaranteed start money, free Michelin race tyres, and no championship registration fees, and it's worth at least £91,000 to each independent who contests the full championship. So when you look at how much it costs you to run a championship, you can probably realise that you've got a good chance there of getting a lot of your money back. Of course, other things this week, announcements being made here in Canberra regarding the National Capital 100, with the announcement there in terms of the naming rights sponsor for the event. And the National Capital 100 is now renamed and is going to be known as the GMC 400. It's after GMC, which is a global machinery company, which is an Australian-owned and operated distributor of power tools to major home hardware chains across Australia. And the 400 now designates the total number of kilometres that the V8 supercars will cover in the three races over the weekend. So we've now gone from the National Capital 100 to the GMC 400. Also this week, interesting enough in my own case, working in the area where the race will be held, they've started... I'm sitting right...
starting already, you bloody public servant.
Yeah, but the thing is, they've already told us the fact that the car parks and the road closures are going to be going on. And I think there might be a few people around the place who are going to be a little bit upset about the fact that they've got no car parking for their office block.
Hey, action buses. Have you ever heard of them? No one else has them.
Yeah, it's going to make it fun again. But anyhow, the thing is that it's good to see they've actually got a major naming rights sponsor for that event, and that should make it go from strength to strength over the next couple of years.
It will do indeed. And Phil Brannigan, don't you love these Albert Park residents here in Canberra?
Well, I was going to ask about the timing for the race in Canberra. Is it going to be a regular sort of race time computing sort of deal, or is it going to be flexi time?
Well, I don't know either. I'm actually sort of interested in the fact that that some of the road closures are going to make it very interesting to see how people get around the city during that time. The most interesting part, I reckon, is going to be how some of the people can work in some of the office blocks nearby when those guys go around and practice on Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to stretch probably the peak hour might stretch out to about 12 minutes.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. All these cars done by people. I'm sorry, I've got no sympathy for public service.
I used to be one, so we'll be nice to them.
What's this you turning up in the pages of Jaguar Racing magazine?
Yeah, somebody rang me in the middle of the night and said, it's Haymarket Publishing here, would you like to drive a Jaguar around Albert Park? And I said, who is this really? And next thing we know, we've done a story for them, so... You know what being a journalist is like. If someone asks you to do something, you always say yes.
Yeah, and then find out what it is later.
Well, actually, it's interesting because Jaguar have got a media day coming up at Calder in a few weeks before Albert Park, and Eddie's going to be there, so we get to compare notes for real.
Okay, then. This week's motorsport news, obviously, the Grand Prix preview this edition will be, and naturally enough, with all the goings on in Formula One and Australian becoming a major stakeholder in Bernie's little enterprise, it's plenty of news going on.
Yes, it is. It's an interesting thing. I guess all the motoring journos around the country are polishing their CVs at the moment because of the link between Fairfax and what's happened about the buyout with Bernie's 37.5% share. But of course, he's still got most of it, so he continues to be happy. But yes, the cars are now being put on the racetrack for the last time before they're tucked away in their Ziploc bags, ready for the trip south to Albert Park. And a flurry of activity, really. It's really starting to heat up now. Parnas and Coulthard have been testing like crazy. The Arrows continue to impress. And, you know, the big question mark is, what is going on? Is the new Supertech engine really new, or is it the old engine, or what the heck's happening?
Traditionally, when they're away from town early in the season, they try to run as much stuff as they can of the older cars, because they don't want silly little hiccups happening to them at the first round, where they realise if you don't get off to a good start, then you've probably kissed your season goodbye.
Well, I mean, so many people point the finger at Arrows and Minardi and say, look, these teams are looking for major sponsors, so it's in their interest to run a car which has not been scrutinised yet. Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with that. Make it run fast to impress potential sponsors. But you're right, they don't want to change the car too much, because then they don't learn anything about it. If the car's 40 kilos lighter than it's going to be at Albert Park, it changes the car completely. So they're going to stay fairly close to the envelope they're going to have at Albert Park. And I think it's good. I don't think anyone's suggesting that McLaren and Ferrari aren't going to be the teams to beat this season, but I think that the battle for the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th teams is going to be really great.
The news which we had recently is, of course, that Arrows, who are one of those people who have been proving to do quite well, have actually put their launch back because they've apparently signed themselves up a new sponsor, so they've had to do a livery change at the last minute.
And that is good news, potentially, for Mark Webber, because there was word late last week that Tom Coronel had landed a major sponsor, so that meant that Dutch companies were going to be pumping money into the team for two drivers. But if they have actually signed up a naming rights sponsor with a lot of money, that's good news for Webber, because everyone at Arrows wants Webber. They don't want Coronel, because when Coronel paid an awful lot of money to go out there and drive a car in Barcelona, he absolutely killed the car. They virtually had to throw away engines and gearboxes and all sorts of things. Webber they like.
Yeah, I think Mark's a little bit more simpatico with the machinery than some of the other drivers around.
Yeah, but Mark probably doesn't know what simpatico means. There's anything wrong with that?
Yeah. Hey, look, one thing that crossed my desk today was the American Motorsport Hall of Fame has announced its inductees. And some of the people in here, quite well known. Sam Hanks, he was the last winner of the, or late winner of the 1953 AAA National Championships, which then became the United States Auto Club.
Yeah, which turned into car eventually.
Yeah, well, we're talking about midgets and cars, sorry. He was the 57 winner of the Indy 500. The Wood brothers, of course, a pioneering stock car family who have still got cars out there on the track at the moment. Danny Ongais, who was a championship drag racing, who also had his turn in IndyCars and sports cars, but he's in there for his drag racing abilities. Peter Gregg was a six-time Camel IMSA GT Series champion. Bob Hanna, the first American super sire of motocross, the Hurricane Hanna, is now an inductee. Tom DeEarth, a powerboat racer, designer and builder, and also historian. Cook Clellan, a post-World War II pilot racer in a 3000 Super Corsair race. Ray Haroon, of course, he was the winner of the first ever 500-mile race when he put a rear vision mirror on the car, forgone his riding mechanic, and took the victory quite easily in the end. And a name that everyone in motorsport loves, Smokey Unick, one of the most innovative mechanics in the history of racing. In some of the stories of Smokey Unick, he built a 5/8 model, or not a model, he built a 5/8 size car and raced it, getting through most of the templates. He was all right up until they parked the two cars beside each other, and then he got bounced for about another 6 months.
Yeah, Smokey Unick's one of those great characters. He's actually got a business in Daytona Beach called the Best Damn Garage in Town. That pretty well sums up Smokey, doesn't it?
Yes, it does indeed. And very, very quick to very, very quick with the one-liners as well, and also very, very quick race car builder. Although he didn't always do things, rule books were there to guide people in ways of building cars to not perhaps go as fast as they should. So he just always threw that aside and did his own thing.
Yeah, it's a great list of names, isn't it? Good to see Bob Hanna in there. He's the world's fastest palindrome, which means you can spell his name backwards and it doesn't change. And he was really the first Americans to take on the Europeans on their own terms and beat them.
Mm. But it begs me the question, how often do we have a Hall of Fame and an inductee in the Hall of Fame?
Not often enough.
Well, I can't even think of where it is, or if there is one.
There's kind of a few fragmented ones around. As far as I know, there isn't an officially sanctioned, recognised, whatever, Hall of Fame. I think there's a Touring Car Hall of Fame, which is put up by Auto Action, and I think they inducted people like Pete Gagan and Alan Moffat into it. But
Sounds like a good job for Inside Motorsport and Motorsport News.
There you go. Co-production.
Let's get the Australian Motorsport Hall of Fame up and running.
And actually build one somewhere with some of the cars preserved.
Yeah, maybe... Well, see, Adelaide has got a great museum, but still no one sort of talks about great drivers and preserving their memories.
That's right, great Australian drivers like Graham McRae and Greg Murphy and...
Now you're just being...
John Richards.
Jim Richards, yeah. Ivan Major.
Ivan Major, now you're talking.
Ludwig Kanauer?
This is Queensland as far as I know.
But in all seriousness, a big Grand Prix edition is coming up at Motorsport News. And of course, then soon after that, we get back into our regular racing series. Of course, the V8 Supercars back on track.
Well, don't forget there's a V8 Supercar race. I think there's three V8 Supercar races at the Grand Prix. Interesting to note who's been tearing up their testing days, who's been doing early pre-season testing, who's been saving their days for later in the season, because now teams are restricted to 12 days. And has somebody else been having a bit of a fudge around the edges? There's all this talk about, you know, because Gibson Motorsport were being spoken about as testing at Mangalore in January. Now there's a lot of finger pointing going on with other teams.
But at the end of the day, if you are just drag racing as such, well, you're not really finding out how the car's handling, are you?
You can do some aero work. Not the aero package is going to change. Anytime you fire up a race car, A, it costs money, and B, you learn something. So the reason behind the 12-day limit is to reduce costs, and I don't know. I'm not saying teams are breaking the rules. All I'm saying is there's an awful lot of conversation out there now because there's so few other areas to point the fingers at.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that means if one of the team engineers, mechanics, goes to move the car from the workshop to transport, a floor's a bit too hard and smokes up the rears, will they count that as a testing day?
My understanding of the rule is any time it goes to either a racetrack or a driving facility and you fire up the engine and drive it forwards, that's considered a test. It's interesting that in kart, they actually have, I think it's a limit of 3 days you can run a car up to 50 miles. But of course, you've got to have observers at the track to independently verify everything. So interesting situation.
Yeah, well, Ivesco will certainly have a look at that and change the rules as accordingly. But I guess at the end of the day, there's a little bit of Smokey Unic in everyone that goes motor racing.
Yeah, there is a little bit of Smokey Unic, and I think that was shown to advantage in the Daytona 500. We've got a full wrap-up from the Speed Week at Daytona in this issue coming up. Of course, Dale Jarrett was invincible. Dale Jarrett lost his race-winning car. That car are going to put in Daytona's museum for the rest of the year. Some interesting development going into that car. Six horsepower was found in their Daytona spec engine since last year at a cost of $1 million.
Yes, and well, with NASCAR announcing new television rights, new media accreditation rights, they are fast becoming the Formula One of tin tops, because they are really clamping down on a lot of different sources and avenues of getting the information out. And it's putting offside a lot of the United States press.
Well, it's interesting that NASCAR actually backed down on their, for those people listening who don't know what we're talking about, NASCAR, on their accreditation letters this season, said, we own everything you write and take photos of. So if we want to reproduce your work, we can do it. And the press went, right, you ain't getting any press this year. So NASCAR actually backed down. That's the first time they've ever done that. So far, they've been able to do their own TV deals, their own radio deals. But like Bernie found out, you can't control the print media. We just will not let it happen.
Yeah, you fellas and your Fifth Amendments.
We ain't got no amendments. This is Australia, boy.
Yeah. Well, Phil Brannigan, thanks for joining us this week on Inside Motorsport. No doubt we'll have a chat to you when the next issue of Motorsport News comes out. And, of course, as I said, the next one will be the big Grand Prix preview. And no doubt you'll have all the latest news and gossip and happenings with that Formula One circus as it heads towards Melbourne.
Yes, and all the local news, and catch up with the drivers that all look forward to a great year.
Thank you very much.
Well, two very exciting nights of racing over in the west as the speed cars were the centre of attention, with the Australian Speed Car Grand Prix, and then a big night at Bunbury. Con Migro joins us on the line, and the Western Australians looking good for the titles in 2 weeks' time, with Mike Figlamini doing it once again.
G'day, Craig. Yes, a fantastic job. I think that currently Michael Figlamini would not only be the best driver in Australia, he'd probably be one of the best drivers in the world. He won, as you know, 3 feature races in America last winter, and he's won the last 4 feature races at Claremont, and they're all blue ribbon events: the West Australian title, the Laurie Matthews Classic, the 50th running of the Australian Speed Car Grand Prix, and then last night the Bunbury Grand Prix. So a clean sheet by the man we call the Magic Man.
Mm. And certainly no slouches amongst the field, which was looking very much like an Australian title field over in the west, and it was great to see so many cars make it that far over for these big events in the closing days of Claremont.
Yes, we've got 6 weeks to go, or 5 weeks to go, 6 race meetings, because the last meeting will be a Thursday and a Friday affair. But yeah, I think we sent Claremont out off in grand style with the talent that we had here. I believe that whilst we might not have had the numbers of the Australian title, I certainly think we had the quality, and we had 33 cars that faced the starter on Friday night, and I think there was about 18 or 19 cars last night. So you can see that to win, or just even make the 18 car final, was in itself quite a feat.
Alright, and with Mike Figlamini in such great form, he is going to be devastating to watch, because one thing that the Eastern States aren't used to is a proper dirt speedway, and I think that might have been the difference between a lot of the drivers and Mike Figlamini, who really knows how to pedal it wide open in the big slide jobs that are required to make dirt racing that little bit quicker and more spectacular.
Well, I think you're right too, Craig, and I spoke to young Craig Brady today, and I may add from the beginning that every one of the boys that came to the West were thorough gentlemen and accredited to the sport, and not one of them failed to come and tell me how pleased they were of being there. And it's very refreshing, because often sprint car drivers come to our shores and to our state, and they think that we owe them a living, and I thought that was very refreshing. But one thing that probably drivers don't realise, that when they come to Western Australia, and I'm not trying to say who's got the better speedway, that's not the point. The fact is that both Claremont and Bunbury are high horsepower tracks, and whilst you go fast at Parramatta, you're probably at another 30 or 40 mile an hour at Claremont, and that's pretty daunting. Now, they'll find that when they go to the Bacchus Marsh track in Victoria, because that is similar to Perth, maybe a little bit bigger and might be a little bit faster, so the West Australians will have a slight advantage in that respect.
one man who does a lot of racing over your way, or has done in the past, but hasn't really hit his form this year, is four-time Australian champion Warren Eakins, and obviously he heading for five titles and the Australian record for number of Australian speed car titles, wants to do well, and once again is another very good dirt track performer.
Well, I would say that probably through the 80s and 90s, Warren Eakins was probably one of the best speed car drivers I ever saw anywhere. He was like a rogue bull. I think he's lost a little bit, and I don't mean that being detrimental to him as well, but I think he made a very tactical mistake by going to Melbourne these last 2 weeks. He should have come to the West. He had the opportunity to come here and race because he could have honed his skills against the top New South Welshmen, as well as, without doubt, the top six or eight West Australians that are extremely good drivers. And I think if Warren had been here, that would have put him in a better stead to get that magical five, because I can tell you now that anyone that beats Michael Figlamini, or even young Craig Brady, or young Troy Jenkins, they'll know they've been on racetrack. So I think Warren should have really thought out what he was doing and done the right thing and jumped up and raced on a track like Claremont and Bunbury.
Well, Colin, it's been a pleasure catching up with you. It's still not over in the West, and we are going to look forward to the big sprint car shows which are coming up to finish the Claremont calendar, and with them we'll be waiting for, with bated breath, to find out the building process of the new facility and the motorplex that is coming along.
All right, Craig. Well, I'll keep in touch, and thanks for the phone call, and we'll look forward to hearing from you over the next couple of weeks.
Tom Margrove joining us once again here on Inside Motorsport.
And time now to talk things Formula One. And of course, we're going to try something a little bit different here. We'll just see if this little trick, which we're going to try now, works. Hopefully it'll work. As always, when you try and get something to work, it never always works as you want it to. No, I don't think it's going to work the way I want it to, so anyhow. But anyhow, joining us on the line is our Formula One man, Rory Gordon. Rory, good evening to you, and how are things over there where you are?
Good evening, gentlemen. What little trick was that? Very well, I am, thank you. What little trick were you just going to try and do there? I'm a spit here.
No, I was actually trying to introduce some Formula One noise, but it decided it wasn't going to come out of the machine.
Oh, dear. These machines are so uncooperative.
Yeah, so it's going to be the wail of a bygone era of a Ferrari Formula One V12 engine.
Oh, dear. Indeed, a wail. Good evening, gentlemen. Yes, it's getting pretty close now, isn't it? It's what, 2 weeks to go until the season starts, and since wrapping up their final testing, some quite interesting results coming out of that testing. But as I always say at this time of year, testing really means absolutely nothing. We don't see the results until the checkered flag drops. So, you know, I mean, you can take the testing results to mean something if you want, but you can take the testing results to mean absolutely nothing if you want. So that's Rory's belief in pre-season testing. However, there were some very interesting times that have come out of it. If you have a look at it, talk about the green machine coming to the forefront. Jaguar has been topping the times, Eddie Irvine and Johnny Herbert, in recent testing. So whether that's going to tell us something, I'm not quite sure. I personally can't see that the team, Stewart as it was, Jaguar as it is now, has made such a vast improvement, or that McLaren, for example, has gone backwards so far that Jaguar can leap so far so soon. I'm a bit sceptical about the figures, about the times, excuse me. But as I said, let's wait and see what happens when they get to Melbourne.
Of course, the thing being as well that in terms of Jaguar, they were having a lot of problems initially with, I think it was oil pump problems or something similar in a lot of their early testing, so they weren't getting the mileage that they liked, but they seem to have overcome those problems to get in the miles at Jerez.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I said, the problem with testing is you're never quite sure what bits are on the car at any particular time. You don't know whether the particular run that the cars did those really fast times on were done, say, with light fuel load, scrubbed in tyres, and you know, everything working absolutely perfectly, the engine nicely warmed up, and all the driver did was go out and blurt out a few laps. as opposed to the other teams who are doing things like race distances. So it's always very difficult to evaluate to times when it comes to testing. You just don't know what the circumstances were. The teams aren't going to tell you what would be the point. So this is why I always like to take test times with just a pinch of salt. I really can't see that McLaren would have dropped so far back so quickly. Well, really, let's face it, McLaren haven't really dropped back. It's just that Stewart, Ford, Jaguar have suddenly leapt up the field and overtaken a lot of people. So, yeah, that's it. Let's wait and see what happens in Melbourne, and then we'll get a fair idea of how the cars might pan out for the rest of the season.
Well, just to run through those testing times from Jerez on Friday, topping timesheets was Eddie Irvine in the Jaguar, 1 minute 24 seconds time, over 35 laps of testing for him, which is actually a bit better than what they had previously. Johnny Herbert, 1 minute 23.32 seconds, did 48 laps on the day. Giancarlo Fisichella in the Benetton, 1 minute 23.410 seconds, over 87 laps, so a lot of mileage there for the Benetton. Jarno Trulli in the Jordan, 1:23.71 seconds over 48 laps. Ralph Schumacher in the Williams, 1:23.89, which is actually interesting, the fact that he's achieved that time with the new BMW Matter over 37 laps. And then Pedro Diniz, 6th in the Sauber, 1:24.060 seconds over 41 laps. 7th, David Coulthard in the McLaren, 1:24.1 over 64 laps, so a fair bit of mileage there. And again, Olivier Panis in the other of the McLaren drivers testing at the time was in 12th place on the day testing, covering 74 laps. So I think it could be a case there. It looks like some people are doing shorter runs, but some people actually into the actual race distance tests.
Exactly, and as I said, the variations between the cars are just so wide that really you can draw, it's like the thing of lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. Test times will prove exactly what you want them to prove. The only way we can really look at the test times is to say, okay, on this day, this car did this with this bit, but when they put that bit on, it did this bit. It did this time. And that's the only realistic way to do it. Although it's quite interesting, as you said then, to have to see Ralph Schumacher with the BMW engine, seemingly not that far behind. So, I know, to be honest, I really don't hold out much hope for Williams this season, and I don't think Williams hold out much hope for this season. They see it as a development season. But very interesting to see Ralph Schumacher up there so well.
Mm. Now, of course, there's been a few various launches around the place. Arrows, we're talking Phil Brown again earlier, they've put theirs back because they've apparently signed a new sponsor. Minardi have come out with their new sponsors, and of course they're going to really cause poor old Murray Walker a few heart failures this year, because they've come out with a largely yellow livery similar to the Jordan.
Oh dear, aren't there going to be troubles? You can see Murray up there already. I mean, by the 15th race of the season he'll still be getting it wrong and calling the wrong driver in the wrong car. He claims that he looks the helmets, and I must admit the only sensible, for me, really sensible way to confirm which drivers in any particular car is to, if you can, check the helmet. Yeah, I can see poor old Murray getting quite confused. He always does between two or three teams in a season, so it's just another case of we'll probably get some more decent Murrayisms out of this season.
Yeah, and Murray can always be guaranteed to give you a couple of good quotes. The interesting thing, though, is a lot of the hype around Jaguar's entry into Formula One, and it's even reached a stage now that, as we've seen released this week, Jaguar Racing have even released their own magazine to capitalise on the interest that is there, to actually put some hype in, and confirm what we've said over the last few weeks. The word I've had already is that if it's green and got Jaguar embroidered on it in the way of clothing, it's going to be the stuff that'll walk out the door this year down in Melbourne.
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's going to be any doubt about that whatsoever. It does seem that the Jaguar hype is well and truly hyped up. The feedback I've been getting from fans both here and overseas is that there's huge interest, and people do have big expectations of it, which, to be quite honest, I hope that they're right. If we base it on the idea that it is the Stewart team, and the Stewart team's now been around for a couple of seasons. They know how the system runs. They've all got used to each other. They know how they got trust in what other people can do. They may do it badly, and they trust the particular person at the particular job that athlete, but they know each other's capabilities. So I think they're much more of a team now than they were when they started a few seasons ago. Unfortunately, I can't see the same happening for British American Racing. I think they're still on the learning curve, if you like, and that they're going to be... I think they'll probably improve over last season. Let's face it, they couldn't get any worse. But I couldn't see Bath doing much better. I hope, as a Briton, that Jaguar do manage to pull off some good results. But I have a bit of doubt about it. I think there's a lot of hype, as you said, involved here, and I'm a bit scared that they're not going to live up to the hype, which is going to be a pity. Mind you, though, I've already got a piece of green clothing with Jaguar embroidered on the back in my wardrobe, so you won't find me tacking around on those tacky shops buying jackets or shirts or anything like that. Mind you, if you do happen to hear of a good one of those nice big Jaguar jackets going green, you know, with fleecy and warm, I'll take it.
Yeah, no, I must admit, I do have a few pieces of Jaguar attire already in my gear, but mine date back to the days of Le Mans sports cars and the American IMSA series, so they're more like silk-cut Jaguar items, which are very collectible and lovely items. But yes, I know there are a few people who are going to be prowling the streets and the locations of Melbourne to try and find their own little piece of memorabilia from Melbourne. But anyhow, Rory, we'll be talking to you again, no doubt, next weekend, just on the eve of the Australian Grand Prix down there in Melbourne, and no doubt you'll have some of the latest news and views of what's happening in that lovely world of Formula One.
I will indeed, and then in this time in 2 weeks, hopefully it will all be over, and the checkered flag will have fallen, and we might have some idea of what's going to pan out for the rest of the season, and we'll certainly the Melbourne Grand Prix will be over and done with for another year.
Okay, thank you, Rory.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
After 4 years of doing Cardos magazine, which has been very enjoyable and very successful, it's time to move on. Nothing's forever, and a great opportunity's come up in Europe, and I'm jumping at it.
It has been quite amazing to see how you have developed the magazine from nothing now to over 140 pages? No, sorry, 60 pages.
Six, yeah.
Okay.
That's 2 issues in one.
Yeah, that's it. to 60 pages, all colour now, and it's just really kicked on from there.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the first few issues we did back in 1996, and I cringe at it, but if you look at the latest issues, which are in your newsagents across Australia and New Zealand, I'm happy to say that it's a far cry from that first publication so many years ago, and not only that, but Cardos is a very well respected name, and the product has become synonymous with karting in Australia, and it's if you knew how it all started 4 or 5 years ago, it was nothing, and now it's a cult thing in Australian karting, and it's really pleasing to see. I'm pleased that I'm able to leave it as a strong entity and not something that's sort of going the other way. It's definitely on the up, and I'm sure it'll continue to grow in future.
But not only have you built up the magazine, but the Win series has gone from strength to strength through the promotions that you've also put through it.
Yeah, it's, that's probably actually one of my greatest regrets, in that I won't be here for this year's series in 2000, which is disappointing, because not only was I dying to race in it once again, but just to see how it has developed. And I mean, we've got drivers that will be in Formula A this year in the Australian series that were only juniors 2 or 3 years ago, or weren't even, you know, or even in rookie classes 3 years ago. And to see how the series has grown, and I remember back 3 or 4 years ago, the guys in Formula A, who are the best drivers in the country, they received nothing in terms of recognition. And now you go to one of the rounds of the Win series, and they're signing autographs for young drivers who want to emulate their feats in a few years' time. It's really good to see, and I mean, I'll be back for the Oceania in November, and hopefully can pick it up in a few months, or 10 months' time, I guess, when I get back on an aeroplane to come back home.
Mm. I guess the other thing is, thank goodness for subscriptions, because you can still get Card Oz even over there.
Yeah. It's a strange feeling, I've got to say. It really, really is. I mean, obviously, no one else is going to have the same sort of emotions, and to be honest, I'm not sure too many people are actually going to care as long as they can get their Card Oz magazine every month. But, yeah, from knowing how every sort of word in the magazine is put together day after day, month after month, year after year, the next issue, the April issue, I guess, I'm going to have no clue what's inside it, and hopefully have it sent to me over on the other side of the world, and I'll be reading it and going to see what's going on in Australian karting. Basically looking at it from the other side of the fence, which is a relieving feeling, but also a very strange feeling as well.
Well, you haven't rested on your laurels in the final edition, which you have been at the helm of, the March 2000 edition. New features in there is a very good trade directory for people who want to know how they can get involved in karting, who they can speak to, and made it very easy to look at and find information. On top of what is most important in a magazine, the stories, which have got some great technical stuff, which even if you're a layman, you'd still enjoy, particularly the super test of the 125 ICC kart, which is one that you're going to enjoy a lot more hands-on information in, as Europe has already really adopted these karts to their heart.
Oh, definitely. I mean, just because one person is leaving this publication doesn't mean it's stopping. I mean, Card Oz magazine will continue to go from strength to strength in years to come, I'm sure. And the latest is issued, and I mean, we're very pleased with. It continues to sort of set the trend, and it's another great addition. That Intercontinental Z Super Test, which you were discussing, is it really is quite interesting, and that's the sort of thing which the magazine is going to concentrate more heavily on in the future.
Mm. Also, another very important one, I guess you decided to run this one along with Sean Henshelwood, who's your successor there, but it is a fairly important one for people to realise. Promotions to get your name in Card Oz, to get your name in any of the magazines, doesn't just happen. You might win a lot of races, but no one will ever hear about you if you don't do some basic things to get your name in front of people. And the promotions story here, and how to promote yourself and how to promote karting, is a very, very important one.
Yeah, that's right. It's I mean, we often get calls wondering how people can get their name in print or what they've got to do to see their boy's face, you know, not only Card Oz magazine but in other publications or on local media or whatever. I mean, it doesn't just happen. You have to work at it. Nothing's going to come to you easily. So we've put in a bit of a story that says, look, this is basically how the motorsport media works, and just by... I wouldn't say following a few basic rules we've put in there, but just keeping these points in mind, it will assist you to gain media and publicity in the future.
A couple other stories that you have in there, just touching on them. A lot of talk about the race that's going to be held in the Superdome there in Sydney, which is going to see the V8 supercar drivers and carters all featuring together.
Yep, that's going to be a sensational event. It's... again, something else I'll miss out on, but it's at the Homebush, I'm not sure the correct venue, because there's so many new venues up there. The Sydney Superdome, which is at Homebush, I think, 30,000 seat stadium, is going to host a kart racing event just 2 or 3 months before the Olympics, and much along the lines of some of the indoor events they run in Europe, we'll have the V8 supercar stars there with the nation's top kart racers. In a very, very unique event. There'll be, I'm sure, light shows and spectacular racing, and it'll basically be a karting concert indoors. Very, very unique, and it's going to be very spectacular, and that's in, I believe, July this year.
Mm. Also, Barnsdale has been one of the forefront clubs that have really got out there and promoted themselves, and this year putting together a fantastic package where not only have they got a great organising committee down there, but they're giving away, or they're having a lottery or a raffle, call it what you will. It's a bit better than a chook raffle, because you can win tickets to the Honda Indy 3000, Indy 300 in 2000, and also a lot of other, about 50 other consolation prizes.
Yeah, that's right. They've really revamped the band's style street race, I think coming into their 10th year in 2000, and an actual Formula 100 Grand Prix and lots of corporate sponsorship involved. I believe they'll actually have some champ cars on display down there. It really will be a sensational event towards the end of May. It's one of the most famous street events in Australia, and it's going from strength to strength this year. And yeah, it's been promoted quite heavily in this edition and the last few editions of Carlos, and I'm sure the magazine will follow that up with their June edition as well.
All right. Now, Ford, making a few interesting announcements over the last couple of months, and they're pushing right into the kart levels of motorsport with their One Make series, with the Rotax involvement there, and trying to build themselves right up a career path right through the Ford ranks, rather than people having to chop and change at different stages to go over to Holden or to Vauxhall or any of the other makes overseas.
Quite interesting. Ford really sort of got stuck right into karting and motorsport promotion, at least in the last 6 months or so, and they've got behind this new 5-round Rotax series, and yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out.
All right. After the 4 years and 37 issues of Cardos, what has been probably the biggest moment for you?
Gee, I don't know, Craig. I look at it from two points of view, from a personal point of view and a professional point of view. I guess every issue has always been a highlight to see the latest issue come out on the presses. The Win Series, no doubt, has been sensational. Racing-wise, it's been sensational. The Eastern Creek Oceania Championships in January of last year, and personally being able to compete in every state in Australia and New Zealand, and just to really be involved and live a really good 4 years. But it's taken its toll, and I'm basically exhausted of it all now, so it's time to move on. But no regrets, it's been fantastic, and I'm sure it'll continue to grow in the future.
And what will you be doing over in Italy?
Racing, for one thing, I'm pleased to say, but secondly, perhaps a little bit more importantly, is working as a freelance journalist covering the Euro and World Car Championships for a number of publications around the world, including Carlos Magazine, which means going to 12 or 13 events this year, basically on the European continent, and being the man on the spot for that, for the major international races, and the weekends where it doesn't clash, be able to compete in the Italian championships and also regional championships in Italy as well. So hopefully it'll be a very different but a very good 2000.
Well, Ian, it's been a pleasure to catch up with you right throughout the time you've been joining us here on Inside Motorsport, and we do wish you all the best over there in Italy, and hopefully we can catch up with you whilst you're staying over there and get a bit of feedback what karting's like over there with you.
Yeah, definitely. We'll can look out for it in the pages of Kart Oz magazine. But no, I have to thank you, Craig. It's been a great association, and I'd like to think we can continue it into the future, and I'm sure Inside Motorsport as well will continue to grow from strength to strength.
Thanks very much, Ian.
No problem.
Ian Silvestrin joining us there. Let's take a bit more. Whoa.
He was very fast, that guy.
Anyway, just some drag racing news now, and I probably should get you to read the last part of this so I can set up the next interview with our postcard from Daytona, a very interesting postcard from Daytona from Peter Norton, our man over there. But Top Fuel at the Australian Drag Racing Nationals, of course, called the park last weekend. Top Fuel, what a final it was. Sainty versus Smith. Roy Smith from Queensland up against New South Wales. Terry Sainty. You probably would never have picked it to be a final when you think that in the semi-final, Sainty was up against DeFilippo and Smith was up against Reed. But DeFilippo broke out, broke the engine, and Reed was just, cruising past the line in a 7.49 time. So it was Smith who ended up beating Sainty to pick up the win. In Top Alcohol in the final, it was Mark Brew who continues on his way with a win over Gary Phillips, the 5.749 at 243.7 miles an hour, over Gary Phillips at 5.732 at 242 miles an hour. So the top qualifier, Phillips, getting done there by the Queenslander, Mark Brew. In Door Slammers, we spoke to Peter Kapiras the last weekend as he went on to beat Robin Judd in the final. So Judd from Western Australia in the Studebaker picking up more good points as he competes once for the Door Slammer Championship. Pro Stock, Peter Ridgway had to beat Bruce Leake to make his way into the final, but he couldn't get past Cognetto with a 7.763 at 176.09 miles an hour. He took the win over Ridgway at 7.72 at 177.72 miles an hour. Ridgway being the top qualifier, it wasn't a good day for the top qualifiers, with the exception of Kapiras, most of them didn't make it through. In competition eliminator, Rod Rainford beat Jeff Gatt. Superstock Lee Heinz beat Ray Karuna. In Super Gas, Colin Griffin has beaten off Neil Roberts. In modified eliminator, Scott Fitzpatrick beat Richard Vigalis. Super Sedan, Jamie Knight beat Daniel Tasmanis. Sebastian Gilanti beat John Trinder in Super Street. In modified bike, Chris Porter, a regular at CID when it was running, took the win over Darren Mason. And in junior dragster, Bradley Allen beat Raymond Gould. And so, as I said, it wasn't a day for the top qualifiers. That leaves the Andra Points Championship for drag racing here in Australia. As such, Darren DeFilippo well out in front in Top Fuel, although it still can be beaten, but DeFilippo with 255 points over Jim Reid, 189, Rochelle Splatt in her Hasta La Vista year, 170 points, Steve Reid with 140, Robin Kirby with 140, Roy Smith 100 points from that win, Terry Saney 80 points, and Romeo Capitano 40 points. In Door Slammers, it's Dave Krupp with 310 over Robin Judd with 285, Peter Kapiras now with 270, Victor Bray with 263, Dave Simpson with 238, Andrew Searle with 180, Brett Stevens 180, Les Winter 120, Marcus Chambers 120, Peter Gratz in the Daytona 100 points, Lindsay Murray with 90, Steve Stanek with 80, Peter Hamilton 60, Ben Gatt 40, and a whole bunch back behind that. In our top alcohol, and Gary Phillips still out in front, but only holding a 5-point lead with Mark Brew's victory at the Nationals. Dean Oakey is back in third place with 160 points, Wayne Newby with 105, Frank Inty from South Australia with 100, Tom Easton with 100, Matthew Featon with 100, and Queensland's Pommy Steve Reid with 80 points in the Australian Top Alcohol Championship. The drag racing attention being turned to the United States, where it is all over at Sunbird Raceway there in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'll let you read that whilst we get to our letter from America Organised.
Okay, and Selzy Katz holds the lead. KJ tops at 200 miles per hour in the ever-crowded professional classes of the NHRA, whittled down to at least the best 16 cars in each bracket Saturday at Firebird International Raceway, with the final two rounds of professional qualifying. Increased temperatures in the Valley of the Sun slowed most of the action at the 16th annual Checker Shucks Cregan Nationals by a fraction. There were still plenty of impressive laps and some Phoenix first during the day's two qualifying sessions. Everyone in the Top Fuel ranks took a shot at the Friday pole sitter Gary Zelty, but he still emerged on top of the class. In front of cars, several cars closed in on Ron Capps, but he simply lowered his best laps time by 0.04 of a second to keep the number one spot. Kurt Johnson made the most news of the day, showing the state of Arizona its first 200 mile per hour lap by a pro stock car en route to garnering top qualifier status. Winston Top Fuel Pro Celsi couldn't improve on his Friday afternoon pass of 4.579 seconds at 317.05 miles per hour, but neither could any of his peers. So the two-time champ from Fresno, California will hold on to the top spot in his class and open Sunday against number 16 qualifier Robert Reel, who held the bump with a 4.846 seconds at 299.06 miles per hour. Celsi has now earned 19 number one qualifying spots in his 3-year career. Dynamax driver Joe Amato moved into the number two position with a nice 4.601 seconds at 317.42 miles per hour, which pushed Miller Lite's Gary Dixon back to third place. Amato will race Jim Bailey in round one, while Dixon draws Dave Grubnik. Reigning champion Tony Schumacher, in relation to Michael, parked his Exide machine on the fourth hole, meaning he could face rival Seltzy in the semi-finals.
Dave Grubnik there, the top of the Australians in, as we go into eliminations, just for going through the other pro events, a plethora of pros closed in on the funny car leaders. Caps during the two days qualifying session, he laughed off his challenges by laying down, get this, a 305.42 mile per hour pass at 4.858 that closed the day's actions. Caps lines up in his US Tobacco's Camaro against final qualifier Bob Gilbertson, who squeaked into the field with a 5.194 at 285.35 miles an hour. The nine-time Castrol King, John Force, is in second position. He's going to drive winner from round number one, Jerry Tolliver, in the WWF car. The rest of the top half of the field ladder shows it's scary in the funny cars, as Castrol's Pedrigan, Del Worsham, Moon Eyes driver Al Hoffman, the Macco Tools pro Dean Suska, and Nitro Fish pilot Phil Burker have all made it through. In pro stock, Kurt Johnson is the first 200 mile per hour pro stock lap, resetting both ends of the track records at Phoenix International, or Firebird International Raceway, as the track records in process were also earning the number one qualifying position. Johnson piloted the AC Delco's Camaro through a stunning 6.89 second pass at 200.38 miles per hour in the cooler morning session, then held on in round four to keep the pole. Johnson will start the Sunday's Total Quest opposite Jamie Yates, who sneaked into the field with a 6.95 at 197.95 miles an hour. Jamie's father, Jim Yates, has finished second on the ladder, and also strong performances from Jet Coghlan Jr., also Mark Cowboy Pork, and Stevens, Vespa, Warren Johnson, and the did not qualifiers was probably the surprise list, including Alan Johnson, John Nobley, Daryl Alderman, Scott Giffran, Steve Schmidt, and Mike Thomas, all failing to make a very close pro stock field. The World Rally Championship, unfortunately, we haven't got through to anyone at the Safari Rally, but
yeah, there's a time difference
there.
We do have
how it all finished yesterday at the end of leg two.
Yes, at the close of leg two yesterday. It was Richard Burns in the Subaru Impreza WRC who was in the lead, closely followed by his teammate Juha Kankkonen, in what was a second puncture-free day for Subaru Camp, in a staggeringly unusual situation for an event that normally leads to punctures left, right and centre. But the hopes of Colin McRae and his Ford Focus, they died in the final section of the day's second leg, when his Ford Focus went into a river crossing and plunged and flooded the engine. Earlier drivers on the stage had said that they believed local fans had dammed the river to make the water deeper to give it a bigger splash. Ford Focus of McRae had emerged from the crossing and the engine had died. They'd finally been able to try it a number of times to fire it up, but it wouldn't go. The stage also spoiled the end of the event for Marcus Gronholm, who's been driving the Peugeot 206 World Rally car. His car was sidelined with electrical failure, and that in fact had put Didier Auriol in the Sayat up into third place. He had not done well in the first couple of days, but had come up to third there, so it actually looks very, very good there for the Sayat team to actually possibly bring out a surprise when anything happens to either of those two Subaru Imprezas at the front of the field.
Well, now it's time to go back over to the United States with a postcard from our very good friend Peter Norton from Daytona.
Yes, good evening, Craig. Now tell me, what do you get if you take 43 cars, a quarter of a million fans, 3 blimps, and spread them across 500 miles at the World Center of Motorsport? Of course, you end up with the Great American Race, the 2000 Daytona 500, which perhaps by now you've heard that Dale Jarrett has won this race for his third time in what many have reported was a boring race. But of course, this is the Daytona 500. It's the Super Bowl of motorsport in the US. So of course it's much more than that. It's the Chevys crying about their lack of speed. The 2000 model has been homologated for a bit more downforce to give them an advantage at the shorter tracks. They pay for that at the big tracks, but with a bit more drag to carry around. Ford Taurus did it a couple of years ago, and they've suffered for the last 2 years. Anyway, now the tables have turned. The Taurus is stronger on the big tracks, and the Chevys now have to learn to go into battle with the package that they've got. There was a lot of lobbying and talk of getting a real change before this race. But hey guys, this is the first race of the season. It's a little early to start crying about these things. What about the fans? The first step to the fans is, of course, you need a ticket. And tickets are one of the hardest things to get. The 2001 race, of course, is sold out already. It was sold out before the 2000 race began. It's a mail order deal. You get your name on that mailing list, you own a seat, effectively. It's only if you don't pay for your seat that they then try to allocate that to somebody else. And it seems as though most of the seats are owned by scalpers and some of these secondary ticket agents. We sell them at a very hefty markup. The $80 ticket ended up costing $200 US. So that's a pretty hefty price to pay. It's close to the track. It was row 15. You pay a whole lot more as you go further up in the stands and get a better view of the whole track. The ticket agent that I went through, they were selling some of their tickets for $700 and $800 US for a fantastic view overlooking the start finish line, great view of the pits. Now, just convert that to Australian dollars, of course, that $800 ends up to be $1,200 each. If you want to take a friend, there's another $1,200 for you. So there's a lot of discussion about scalpers and ticket prices and ticket availability in the world of NASCAR at the moment. One of the big things that annoyed me is that quite obviously these organisers believe the stereotype that their fans are stupid rednecks. There's no signs to tell you which car parks to go to, no signs to tell you how to get to your grandstand. These guys really do believe that the rednecks are stupid and can't read or can't follow instructions. And talking about car parks and traffic, it's a 1 hour drive from Orlando to Daytona Beach. But not on race day. It took 4 hours and 15 minutes door to door. And that included a traffic jam that started 45 miles out. That was miles, keep in mind. That's about 75 kilometres of traffic jam. What a nightmare. And of course, with the absence of any signs telling you which car parks to go to, you just take the first one you can find and hope for the best. And it worked out fine if you don't mind catching a shuttle bus to another shuttle bus to catch a little trolley car. That's right, three bus connections to get to the grandstand seats, which took a little over an hour by itself. So you finally get to your grandstand seat, only to find that it is about 40 centimetres wide. They cram the fans in like sardines. It really is amazing. By this time, you've just about had enough of this so-called sport called NASCAR. They've ripped you off blind for your tickets. They've treated you like a sheep. They don't treat you with any respect as a fan. You are ready to blow your top. But then the race starts, and seeing that the full field of 43 cars whiz past at 200 miles an hour, somehow all of that horrible stuff is forgotten. This is NASCAR. This is fantastic. That's just an amazing transformation that comes across the crowd. All of the aggro and tension of getting to your seat disappears during lap one. And the first 50 laps, everyone was standing in the stands. In fact, after a while, people couldn't see well enough while they were standing, but everyone stood up on their seats. It really is quite amazing seeing that many people all standing on their seats all together. And also amazing was the fantastic loud cheer at about lap 30 when Jeff Gordon came into the pits in a big cloud of smoke. Jeff Gordon, they either love him or they hate him, and there's always a big cheer no matter what he does. I think the cheer when he fails is that little bit louder than when he does something. Through about lap 50, It was really quite amazing. The racing got a little bit processional. Everybody sat down. Everyone's up, everyone's down. And I think this is where the race got its reputation for being a little bit of a yawn. From about lap 50 through to lap 150, not a whole lot happened. There was a little bit of manoeuvring back in the field, but there was very little happening up front. And it was only in the last 50 laps did the race really come back to life again. Okay, there were a few pitting incidents in the middle there, but nothing too significant. It was in the later part of the race that Dale Earnhardt Sr. Tangled with Jimmy Spencer, and the poor innocent victim in all of this was Michael Walford, who was having a reasonable day up until this point. He was put into the wall pretty hard. His day was over. Dale Earnhardt managed to continue quite luckily without any real damage. And it was about this point that Johnny Benson sprung to the lead. In the motor pit stops, he went for two tyres instead of the four, and lo and behold, there he is up in the front. And everyone was thinking, could this be a Cinderella story? Johnny Benson, not one of the better known drivers. Last year he was one of the five cars in the Rouse team. Didn't do too much last year. This year he's off to a new team with no sponsorship. On Sunday night, the car was just plain white. At the last minute, managed to secure some sponsorship from the internet search company Lycos, who were, I think, must have been very happy to get the exposure they did. He was out in front of the Daytona 500, the biggest TV crowd for motorsport, or for NASCAR at least, and he led for 30 laps. And unfortunately, because he only had the two fresh tyres, he just couldn't keep running the same lines that the Fords could, and it was really looking just a matter of time before he slipped back in the pack. It was about this time that the second place was held by the Ford of Mark Martin, and it had all been arranged with the Fords following closely behind him from Dale Jarrett and his and Mark Martin's teammate Jeff Burton that on a particular lap they would all run wide and pass Benson on the outside. Mark Martin, he slipped wide just as the plane was going. Dale Jarrett and Jeff Burton ducked to the inside, and Mark Martin was left to hang out to dry. Mark Martin was very diplomatic after the race, but it was quite clear reading between the lines. He was mighty upset that he was set up like that. Thought that his so-called friends just outright lied to him and cost him his chance of winning the big race. I'm sure the tables will be turned some other time in the future. So that was with Dale Jarrett following Johnny Benson, and sure enough, Johnny Benson couldn't hold the line. Dale Jarrett managed to get inside, and of course all the Fords followed Dale Jarrett through. Johnny Benson was left outside of the draft, and no one was going to let him back into that Congo line. Johnny Benson regained at the end of the line, way back in 12th place. That left us with just a few laps to go, and with only two laps to go, further back in the pack, one car clobbers the wall right on the start-finish line. This left one of the NASCAR intriguing situations where there's caution on the speedway, there's a wrecked car, but the race will be decided in effectively a one-lap sprint back to the start-finish line to see who takes the yellow flag. And then, of course, they hold position to come back around to get the checkered flag. Have to be careful because there's a wrecked car. What if this driver needed urgent assistance? Well, forget that. There's $2 million on the line. The whole pack of cars, they're full on racing to get back to the start-finish line where the stranded car happened to be. Luckily, there wasn't any real problems here. No one was injured, and people kept out of the way of the wrecked car, and Dale Jarrett effectively cruised to victory to win his third Daytona 500. So let's just run through the results. Dale Jarrett first. He now loses his car for 12 months. The winning car goes into the Daytona USA Museum, located just outside the track. It's part of the rules of racing there that the winning car, you have to give it up for 12 months. But Robert Yates Racing, I think they can afford it. Dale Jarrett claimed the record prize purse for any particular race. He won the race prize money, but also the tobacco company No Bull bonus money, and walked away with a cool $2.2 million. I think they can afford to replace the car that's going into the museum. Second was Jeff Burton, third Bill Elliott, and we want to watch for the rest of the season, and it's looking more and more likely that next year he will end up driving a Dodge. Yes, the Ford man for the whole of his career, for his twilight years, will be driving a Dodge, if all of the reports are to be believed, and then we'll follow that one with interest in the future. Rusty Wallace was at the pointy end of the field all day, and he came home fourth. Mark Martin, unlucky, the flames let him down when it counted, came home fifth. And yes, that's all Fords that we've seen so far, 1-5. The first Pontiac was Bobby Labonte, from sixth. The first and only Chev Monte Carlo in the top 10 was Terry Labonte in seventh, then followed by Rod Burton, Kenny Schrader, and Matt Kenseth rounding out the top 10. What about the poor old fans again who were following their woes? Yes, 250,000 people all piling out of this track all at once. Reversed the trip on the three buses, back to the car park, and looking at the very long journey home in the big traffic jam. This is where we had quite a bit of luck. We got lost and couldn't find our way back onto the parking lot that is normally Interstate 4, and we ended up travelling the back roads around Daytona and Central Florida. And getting lost, I think, saved us 2 hours. We never came across the traffic jam, had a dream run all the way back to Orlando. We know that NASCAR is the fastest growing motorsport in the world, the fastest growing sport. Why is it so successful? One thing is for sure, it's not because they treat their fans well. I've mentioned the hassles with tickets. The average race fan is finding it harder and harder to get a ticket, and they're getting more and more expensive. A lot of resentment building because they're going through, having to go through scalpers and paying top dollar. It really is quite ridiculous. Okay, the tracks are putting in some good efforts for moving the people around with the buses and things like that. But come on, guys, give us some signs and do something about the traffic jams. And as I mentioned, they really do seem to treat the average fan as an idiot. And perhaps they are, because the fans keep coming back in their thousands. Something that is addictive about the full field of cars whizzing past at those speeds. Like I mentioned, when lap one commenced, all of that horrible stuff was forgotten. NASCAR has grown quite dramatically in the last little while, partly because of the big money the corporates bring. All of the traffic hassles didn't apply to the big corporates. They had a helicopter shuttling them from the track to the airport, which was just across the road, and then the corporate jets were just lined up on the tarmac ready to fly out of Daytona. These people would be back in New York City by the time I'd driven about 100 kilometres back to Orlando. But that's the same in all motorsport. It's sounding very much like Formula One and the Bernie Ecclestone type business deals that are going on there. And of course, that's one of the big talking points this year. The NASCAR TV rights have recently been sold for $2.4 billion. That's right, that was billion with a B. It's really getting into a serious league, and NASCAR have great plans in terms of media coverage and investing in TV networks and things like that. It sounds an awful lot like Formula One. And there was also a lot of the fun and games where NASCAR are trying to control or over-control some of the licensing and the broadcast rights and all sorts of things there. A lot of building resentment in the specialised press about some of the new rules that are being imposed upon media and other people, including the race teams themselves, taking away the race team's right to be able to promote themselves and sell merchandise that sells the team. You can't do that because you're contradicting some of the NASCAR merchandising. They're all things that a sport that's growing very quickly, there's the growing pains that you might have to go through. But the bottom line is, NASCAR has a fantastic product. We've got great personalities in the drivers. You've got very tight rules that are keeping the racing nice and close. Okay, sometimes with the restrictive plate racing, you don't have the passing that you'd like to see, but generally it's nice and close. You've got the race teams themselves, who are very strong on the cross-promotion with their sponsors, doing a fantastic job promoting themselves, their sponsors, and their sport. And the marketing is working very well. Very clever strategy, targeting families, targeting the whole family. A lot of females and children going to these races as well. The ladies are getting right in there behind their favourite drivers, just as much as the fellows. So it's really coming down to the age-old great debate in a lot of professional sports at the moment. The average guy in the street, the grassroots fan, is finding himself shut out of the sport that he loves, as the sport is selling out to the big corporate sponsors, the big corporate TV rights, and all of that, can become a real problem, because motorsport is all about the grassroots and people working their way up to the big time. And there's people in the corporate jets. I don't think that they're likely to be in the middle of a little dirt speedway in the middle of winter volunteering to be a flag marshal. That's the problem I see with over-corporatising these things. And also the average guy in the street. You know, the sport really belongs to him. Until next week, that's it. Goodbye.
Thanks once again to Peter Norton. Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat, with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.